Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Steve Luxemburg is a journalist, editor, and author. He last visited Traverse City in 2014 when he spoke on the stage of the City Opera House about his book Annie's Ghosts. Steve's latest book is Separate, the story of Plessy versus Ferguson and America's journey from slavery to segregation. It tells the story of the landmark 1896 Supreme Court case that shaped the nation's separate but equal race policies for over half a century. Steve talks this hour with Interlochen Public Radio Morning Edition host Dan Wanshura. Dan asked Steve how long it took to write his latest book.
You know, I just was interviewed backstage by a high school student, and she wondered why it took 10 years between books. Like, it was something wrong with you? Did you, like, have an accident? Or? You know, you don't bite off 70 years of history and chew it without spending a lot of time, so it took me basically 6 years between writing and reporting.
Wow.
And the publisher held it up for a little while because it, you know, they didn't think the timing was right to bring it out before the midterm elections in 2018, which just makes it look like I took even longer.
Well, I want to talk about your process a little bit later, but for those of you who are maybe just walking in and don't know kind of the premise of the story, that's where I want to start tonight. So it centers around the Plessy versus Ferguson case. It's a 1896 case, and it centers around this notion of separate but equal. I was talking with a friend who was coming tonight, and he said, most of us knew the right bubble to fill in when we were taking the SAT in regards to the Plessy case, but that's about it. You know, separate but equal is kind of the catchphrase that we've associated with that case, but it's so much more than that, and that's what your book delves into. The backstory, the characters who played an important role in that case. But tell us a little bit about just the general overview of Plessy versus Ferguson and separate.
So there are several reasons why I wrote the book, but you know, what I'd like to say is that of course I chose a book that let me go to New Orleans for weeks on end. Who would not want to go to New Orleans, right? So the case comes out of New Orleans. It's really a character in the book. And the reason that I'd say that New Orleans is a place that probably the only place in the country that could have come, this case could have come out in the 1890s, is because New Orleans was unlike any other city in the country in terms of its racial population. Today, even, New Orleans is unique. You have a lot of people with all kinds of shades of color in New Orleans because when the Americans took over in 1803, remember, we didn't always have Louisiana in the Union. The Americans purchased Louisiana territories and included New Orleans. They arrived to find that there were 6,000 free people of color who had achieved their freedom under the French and the Spanish. 6,000. And the governor who was sent down, I mean, there was no election yet, he discovered that they had weapons. They had a militia. And so he sent a letter to Madison, who was Secretary of State, and Jefferson, who was the president. It took, this is about important to remember about the 19th century, it took a month for the letter to go by ship to Washington. It took a month to get a reply. And in answer to his question, what do I do? Because, you know, in the South, you don't have a lot of people with weapons who are people of color. Madison basically said, you're on your own, buddy. And so he kind of muddled through. So the case, 100 years later, in the 1890s, now, we're going to talk about this later, but by the 1880s and the 1890s, laws were being enacted that mandated separation in public accommodations, and Louisiana had enacted one of them. There was a group of protesters. They were of this mixed race, free people of color group. By the 1890s, they had accumulated enough wealth and education and clout that they could organize a legal strategy and a committee to oppose this law. I don't think that could have happened very easily in Charlotte or Richmond or Savannah. They brought this case as a test case. They called it that. Later on, if you want, we'll play a little Plessy Jeopardy, and I'll give you some answers, and you can give me the questions.
You can be Alex. I'll be Johnny Gilbert.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I'm going to be Alex. You don't want to be Ken Jennings?
Maybe James. Jeopardy James.
Are you speculating about who's going to take Alex's place when he retires? Any rate, the case, just very simply, it's synonymous with separate but equal. I call it the most famous case, Supreme Court case in American history that no one knows anything about, which is, of course, good for me. How many people in the audience are lawyers, judges? You studied this in law school. The briefs in the case, the decision itself, the dissent in the case, you can learn nothing about the backstory of this case. And that's typical of many Supreme Court decisions because they're focused on the constitutional question or the statutory question. I didn't want to write that book. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I'm a storyteller. I wanted to write about the people who got caught up in the case. They're changing, they're evolving views over their lifetime. It was a 7-1 decision upholding the idea that separate could be equal. The majority decision was written by a man who came from Massachusetts to Michigan as a young man, became a lawyer and then a judge. If you look at his background, he grew up in an abolitionist neck of the woods. You would have thought he would have been against upholding separation. The only dissenter in the case is the only Southerner. There were two Southerners, but he was the only Southerner who was in dissent. He was from Kentucky, a border state. He had been a slaveholder son when he was growing up. He inherited his family's slaves. He ran as a pro-slavery candidate for Congress. He is the dissenter in the case. As a writer, that tension of people having the reverse positions that you would have expected, it's unexpected, that drew me to this story.
Another thing I thought was really interesting when I read your book was this wasn't something that just happened out of the blue. This was something that was planned specifically to happen in Louisiana and specifically to a particular gentleman, Homer Plessy.
Yeah, so if you're a lawyer and you want to argue a case before the Supreme Court, and there's a committee of New Orleanians who are bringing this test case, you want to create the right conditions for the best argument that you can make. Now, it's really important to understand that in the 1890s, the Supreme Court was not like the Supreme Court today. So I don't know about you guys, but when I'm listening on the radio and I hear that there's a Supreme Court case coming up, I immediately think, what? 5-4, division, swing vote, who's going to be on what side, conservative versus liberal. Forget about that in the 19th century. In the 1890s, there were some terms, that is the year that the Supreme Court is sitting, where there are 0 5-4 decisions, 0. 90% of their cases were decided unanimously, 90%. They really cared about public opinion. And if you noticed, is this a surprise to you? The Supreme Court has no police force to enforce its rulings. It has to rely on the credibility of the court and public opinion. So it really cared about that. And they were all of the same class. They were all white men. They come from wealth and privilege. They cared about property rights mostly. Civil rights is a new area of the law. There aren't a lot of civil rights cases. Plessy is hardly the first. And so that's the conditions in which you're trying to bring a case. So you don't get to the Supreme Court because you say, I want to get to the Supreme Court. You say, I got to get the right strategy. I might not make it. I don't know whether it will get out of the state courts. So they wanted to create the best conditions. And one of the things they did was they wanted a volunteer who fit the argument that they were going to make. And their argument basically was, you can't enforce this law that requires black and colored, that was the term at the time, colored passengers to be separated on a railroad car, in a railroad train, because you can't tell the race of everybody in New Orleans. So they wanted somebody who looked as white as possible. Homer Plessy could pass for white. And they wanted him to sit in the car, and they wanted to make sure that he was arrested under the separate car law. He couldn't be arrested for disorderly conduct, because that's not the law they're challenging. So they hire a private detective to be in the wings to come forward and take Plessy off to jail and write the complaint, making sure that he was arrested under the separate car law. That was the conditions they were looking for.
In your book, you talk about how no Supreme Court ruling sits in isolation. There's always court cases that lead up to it and always kind of the ramifications of that decision years following. What were the conditions leading up to Plessy?
Well, after the Civil War, there were three constitutional amendments. Three. It's hard to even get one these days, right? When's the last? Anybody know the last one? The 25th Amendment, which is about presidential succession in the case of illness, et cetera. There were three. They were all passed within 5 years. And I would say that the most important people in Washington between 1865 and 1875 did not live in the White House. They lived in the Congress. Now, I just made a mistake. Even authors make mistakes. You know, the 13th Amendment was passed before the Civil War ended in January of 1865, but it wasn't ratified until later. Those amendments are a revolution. Remember that the Constitution originally had the three-fifths clause, a compromise that gave the South more political clout, that counted an enslaved person as three-fifths, because the South wanted them counted entirely but didn't want to let them vote. But they wanted to have them counted as a whole person. The North wasn't going for that, and so we had the three-fifths clause. Well, now, 13th abolishes slavery. The 14th gives equal protection and due process and citizenship rights to people of color. And the 15th is voting rights for black men, not black women, not any women, black men. Well, that's a huge change. And it causes just the kind of tumult and chaos that you would think it would cause. There is often resistance to Supreme Court cases. Think about Brown versus Board of Education, which essentially overturns Plessy. We now think about it as that was the key moment, 1954. They said desegregation must occur in schools. And then what happened? Well, two Southern governors, Alabama and Arkansas, stood in schoolhouse doorways and basically said, over my dead body, will you desegregate these schools? And federal troops were sent down. That's a resistance. Today, the Colorado cake-baking case, after the Obergefell decision that said same-sex marriage was constitutional, is a resistance to that decision. So it's typical to have resistance. So those new civil rights amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th, they give rise to legal cases that are new because there were no such amendments before. And between 1873 and 1896, when the Plessy case is decided, there's a half a dozen civil rights cases that come up as a result of those amendments and conditions that gave rise to them.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Steve Luxenberg talks more about the history of race and segregation in America.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanshura talking with author Steve Luxenberg.
In between Plessy and Brown versus Board of Education, it's about 60 years. What sort of things were the consequences of the Plessy decision being separate but equal was constitutional, or some of the consequences that followed that ruling in between Brown and Board of Education?
Well, you used the term before that Plessy was a landmark case, which it is. I mean, it's a very notable case, one of the worst in Supreme Court history, most people would say. But it wasn't considered to be a landmark when it came out. There was hardly a ripple because the white newspapers expected that would be the way the case would go. They expected the Supreme Court to uphold the Louisiana law. When my newspaper, the Washington Post, When the lead lawyer for Plessy was the most famous white advocate for civil rights in the country, and I suspect that most people here do not know his name today. His name was Albion Turgay. He was not so notable for his legal work. He was notable because he was a best-selling novelist. From his 15 years spent, he was a northerner, spent in North Carolina. He wrote a novel called A Fool's Errand by One of the Fools. And so when the Washington Post, when he came to town for the oral argument in Plessy in April of 1896, the Post said almost nothing about his argument, but instead said, the celebrated novelist is here in town today, Albion Turgay, on another fool's errand. That was the coverage. Unfortunately, I would have liked to have had the paper tell me something about the oral argument. Instead, what we have are 50 note cards that Turgay left behind of the argument he planned to give. And he may have given that entire argument, but there's no record of what he said. So we can only speculate that he gave most of that argument.
And I can confirm you've read two of those novels.
I have read two of those novels. They are quite melodramatic, and they're kind of polemic because he's making certain points about the relations between the races. I did not read his entire novelistic output. I didn't think I needed to, and I, you know, it took me 6 years. I didn't want to take another 6 years.
Steve, it was pretty enlightening. I always imagined Jim Crow laws came from the South. I was talking to a colleague at Interlochen, and we were exchanging emails, and he asked the question, how far north did Jim Crow laws extend in the early 1900s? I was really fascinated to find out that in some cases they originated in the north, which would not be what you would think.
So the first separation on a railroad train occurred in Boston, Massachusetts, the cradle of northern liberty, right? In 1838, at the dawn of the railroad age. And I want everybody here to understand that the railroad was a technological revolution. It was like, to us, it's like the cell phone. To get on a railroad car, even one going just 10 miles an hour, which was what the early trains went, and even though it was smelly and you know the fumes from the engine would waft into the car, you still preferred to be indoors in bad weather compared to a horseback. When the Eastern Railroad and two others began operation in that year, and then there were eight railroads operating by 1840, Only three of them separated their passengers. Now, you might think, wow, that's amazing. You know, like, why would they do that? Well, why would they do that, especially since there were fewer, according to the 1840 census, fewer than 1% of Massachusetts' population were people of color. And guess where they weren't? They were not on the railroad trains. They were not users of railroads. But there was one group that was a user of the railroad, and it had one black employee, and that was the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, the abolitionists. And their newest agent in those years was a guy named Frederick Bailey, who now called himself Frederick Douglass, recently escaped from his enslaved conditions in Maryland. And Mr. Douglass was not gonna leave his seat easily. He was a resister. And part of the story in Separate is the story of the resistors, not just the story of the lawyers and the judges who argue the case. And I begin with Frederick Douglass, who writes memorably in his autobiography that when he was confronted by six members of a railroad crew and told to go to the Jim Crow car, that he gripped the sides of his seat so hard that he lifted the seat right up off of the bolt. The bolts that made it attached to the floor. In the newsroom, we call this a story too good to check. So Mr. Douglass did something memorable. He resisted every time he got on the train because the abolitionists were like any good community organizers. They saw a good issue here and they wanted to bring a petition, which they did, to the Massachusetts legislature, asking them to ban separation as barbaric, ban separation on the trains, the three railroad lines. But there was another guy whose name is hardly known. His name is David Ruggles. He was the opposite of Douglas. He was 33, he was slightly built. He could not lift anything off of its bolts. He couldn't even fight off one conductor. He was going blind from an early case of cataracts. He died at a young age. And he did something that Douglas did not do, which is really important to this story. He took his grievance into the New Bedford Police Court and filed assault charges against the conductor and the railroad. And every resister who comes after that stands on the shoulders of Ruggles. Plessy stands on the shoulders of all those people who came before them. I can give you their names. Mary Miles, a teacher in Philadelphia in 1867, and William Nichols, a guy who wanted to desegregate the streetcars in New Orleans in 1867. William Howard Day here in Michigan, who refused to sit outside on a steamboat trip from Detroit to Toledo on the Detroit River. They wouldn't sell him a cabin for him and his wife, and so he left the train and went into court. And these are some of the resistor stories that are told in Separate.
At the risk of oversimplifying,
oh, heck,
this notion that I'm going to lay out, you know, growing up, you learn about the Civil War, and you think North, they're the ones for abolition. They're the ones who don't believe in slavery. They want slaves to have their freedom. You think of the South as wanting their way of life, wanting to maintain that institution. The Civil War had those issues, but from reading your book, I kind of understand it's not that the North necessarily wanted equality for blacks. They viewed equality as social intimacy, being on the same level as them, having to integrate, and that's not something they wanted. So they were opposed to slavery, yet they didn't want that equality. That's something that's kind of hard to understand. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, the North was just as prejudiced as the South, but not most of the North would have been uncomfortable with slavery. But the abolitionists were radicals. They were not the mainstream. Similarly, it would be incorrect to think that most of the South, most of the white people of the South had slaves. Most people did not have slaves because they didn't have the kind of economic situation that required slaves. But, you know, of course, there were 3 million people in slavery. It was a huge, huge issue. And the dispute between the North and the South, which today I think what we have is a convenient narrative. Oh, South, that racism was a Southern problem, and the North doesn't have that. But of course, I just told you that William Howard Day couldn't get a cabin on a Michigan steamboat in 1855. And that happened in Philadelphia and happened in other places. So when I started doing my research for this book, I created a Google alert. How many people have Google alerts? So you can create these things where you get keywords, it brings you articles about that. So I wanted all things Plessy. All things Plessy, which included lots of things that I didn't read, like stories about the Homer Plessy School today in New Orleans. There's a Homer Plessy School. But I would get alerts and it would bring me a summary of the Supreme Court case in articles that were about something else, but you needed to have a reference to Plessy, and it would say the following. In Plessy, the Supreme Court created the doctrine of separate but equal and made it the law of the land. Now, we're all good historians here, right? What's wrong with those two ideas? Did the Supreme Court create a doctrine of separate but equal? Well, if there's a doctrine in the majority decision, you would expect to find it called a doctrine. That's a pretty substantial word. There's no doctrine announced about it. Separate but equal doesn't even appear in the majority decision. Those words do not appear. Similarly, did it create anything? Well, no, it was created in a Massachusetts railroad train, we know now, and other places. So what they did was to sanction it, uphold it. Similarly, does the Supreme Court make laws? No, that's the Congress's job. Did it make it the law of the land? Well, wait a minute. All it did was uphold a Louisiana law. Other states would have to pass their own laws. So why do I care? Why am I making this point? Well, here's the point. I think we create that narrative because it places the blame for separation and its consequences, the consequences that come up right to today, at the feet of those nine justices, or eight only participated in the decision, eight at the Supreme Court. And you know, it's not just the Supreme Court's fault. It's your fault and my fault and our fault. It's the fault of the North. It's the fault of the South. It's the shame of the country and not of any one group of people.
Which brings me to my next question. Like, why did we want that separation? You mentioned the original Constitution counted black people as 3/5 of a person.
Enslaved black people.
Enslaved black people. So, like, what's the fuel behind that want for separation?
Well, today we talk about white supremacy as represented by the incidents at Charlottesville in Virginia as a kind of outlier philosophy, but white superiority was endemic in the country in the 19th century. Now, I think it's wrong to dismiss everybody white in the 19th century as racist, because that doesn't help us understand what really happened. I want to understand what really happened. And as I said, there were resistors to separation, and those resistors were primarily African-Americans, but they weren't only African-Americans. They were also white allies who were resistors to separation. So it does no good to just paint everybody with a single brush. It never is any good in history to do that, in my opinion. But there's all kinds of underlying issues here. The issue of white supremacy that arises after the Civil War in the South, where the Ku Klux Klan is born in 1867 in Tennessee and spreads to North Carolina and to other places, it's a reaction to losing the Civil War, to a loss of political power, to the amendment that provides voting rights for black people, for black men, and the fear that you are going to be an outcast in your own society. That's what the white people of the South felt. And they respond with violence. They respond with anger. They respond by lynching people in the 1880s, starting in the 1880s and continuing until almost mid-century in the 20th century. You cannot understand the story unless you understand that this is all undergirded by violence. And, you know, the Plessy family, there's no slaves in the family until it's way back in the 18th century. That's Louisiana, that's New Orleans. But in the rest of the South, you have liberated people who were not allowed to be educated. And they have a huge mountain to climb before they reach any sort of parity with white Americans. So if you're a black person in the 1880s, you are not thinking about a concept of public accommodations and where you're going to sit on a railroad train. That's not your first order of business. Your first order of business is survival. And if you want to know how a black person saw the world in the 1870s, I'll read you what Frederick Douglass said. You want me to do that?
Sure.
Frederick Douglass said at the 1876 Republican Convention. Now imagine a black man speaking at the Republican Convention. So here's what I wrote. Not very long, I promise you. Amid the bartering and brokering and bantering about delegate counts, it was easy to lose sight of the issues that had defined the Republican Party since the war. The Republican Party was, of course, the party of anti-slavery, founded in 1854, right here in Michigan and in Wisconsin, in Jackson. Near the end of Wednesday's opening session, a surprise speaker brought those questions back to the fore. Addressing his first presidential convention, Frederick Douglass sharply reminded the delegates that equal rights, he's talking about the amendments, equal rights was still a goal to be attained, not an achievement to be celebrated. He said, listen to his sarcasm, "You say you have emancipated us. You have, and I thank you for that. You say you have enfranchised us. You have, and I thank you for that. But what is your emancipation? What is your enfranchisement? What does it all amount to if the black man, having been made free by the letter of your law, is unable to exercise that freedom, and having been freed from the slaveholder's lash, is to be subjected to the slaveholder's shotgun. He then said, "You turned us loose," in other words, you liberated us, "you turned us loose to the sky, to the storm, to the whirlwind, and worst of all, you turned us loose to the wrath of our infuriated masters. The question now is, do you mean to make good on the promises in your constitution?" And then I write, "Your law, your constitution," words carefully chosen to reflect the sting of separation. The point he was making, of course, was that he got to vote for none of this in the 1860s, and then not right away until after the 1870 amendment. And so these amendments were enacted by legislatures and a Congress that had only white people in it. So in Douglass's view, it was your law, your constitution.
Was a lot of the motives behind segregation and Jim Crow laws and separate laws, was it to maintain political power?
Absolutely, to maintain power. I mean, that's the first order of business.
I remember when President Obama was elected in 2008, there was talk that America is moving on or kind of maturing in terms of racism. This term, post-racial America, became popular. Do you think we're in a post-racial America?
Do you? Well, I started to write this book, started to research the book, at the end of Obama's first term in 2012. Now, I think that was 2008 and his re-election. That is a remarkable moment in American history and politics. You cannot diminish it. But it didn't feel like, when I was living in Baltimore, as I do, working in Washington, it didn't feel to me in 2012 like we were in a post-racial America. Now, the issues that we were discussing back then centered around a lot of confrontations with police. That was then, and those confrontations continue. Today, we're talking about different racial issues. But I think it's important to take the long view. I mean, Martin Luther King said that, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. That's one of his famous statements. That statement means nothing if you think that everything is hunky-dory. It's still it's a work in progress. And I would say that instead of being in a post-racial America, we should remember that racial justice in this country has never come easily or swiftly. We are still working on it. And the one thing that I've really learned, you know, when you write a book, you learn about the book that you wrote by going on a speaking tour and talking with the audience. That's how you learn what you wrote. And one of the things that I've learned in my 50 talks about separate is that, by and large, generally, people who are white and people who are black do not see the world quite the same way. So you can't talk about anybody as a generality. Some whites, some blacks, but many whites will say, "I don't see race." And many blacks will say, "I don't have the luxury of not seeing race." Many whites will say, "I think that officer who had that confrontation with a black man deserves a second chance because there's no evidence of any racism in his background." A fair statement. But many blacks will look at that same confrontation and they will say, "I didn't get a second chance when he pushed me up against the wall." Many whites will say, "Why are we always talking about race? Why can't we talk about the progress we've made?" And many blacks will say, "We've made a lot of progress. We need to make a lot more." My small contribution to this discussion that I think we need to have, because let's face it, race is our national conversation. We're either talking about it or we're avoiding talking about it. And I would say that this is my small contribution. And what I'm trying to do is to have a more honest conversation. And you only get to that honesty by listening to each other. Now, talk is cheap, it's easy. But we have to understand that for many black Americans, slavery is not a historical issue. Jim Crow is not a historical issue. Convict labor in the South is not a historical issue. These are stories that are told in black families today by great-grandmothers, grandmothers, parents. they're a continuing trauma for many people who are black, even if they haven't experienced those things themselves. If you have experienced discrimination, then it's definitely not ancient history.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Dan Wanshura's conversation with Steve Luxenberg, author of Separate, the story of Plessy versus Ferguson.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Dan Wanshura's conversation with Steve Luxenberg.
When I was preparing for this interview, Steve,
I'm sorry for you.
I remembered a podcast I had listened to. You guys heard of Malcolm Gladwell? Any fans out there? He has a really cool podcast. But in one of the episodes, he talks about this idea of, it's called moral licensing. And I want to read what he says. It's, past good deeds can liberate individuals to engage in behaviors that are immoral, unethical, or otherwise problematic. Behaviors that they would otherwise avoid for fear of feeling or appearing immoral. Basically, when we do something good, we can convince ourselves that we almost deserve to be able to do something bad. And he uses the case of America electing Barack Obama as president, and now are we experiencing that sort of backlash? Do you think, are we tricking ourselves in terms of making progress racially in America?
Well, we've deceived ourselves. It's hard to talk about we. I'm feeling comfortable, but there's no we here. There's we the country, but not we the people, if you know what I mean, because there's so many different points of view. But as a nation, we've tricked ourselves about our racial history for a long time. So it was the South's problem. We've already talked about that. Not the North's problem. That's one of the deceptions. I don't think that President Obama's election was a deception. It was real. People who had never voted, perhaps, for a black man in their lives, I'm talking about in local and state races, were voting for Barack Obama. So I'm not sure that I would agree with Malcolm on that. Malcolm used to work at the Washington Post, so I happen to know him. But I think that he's certainly right in thinking that we like to talk about our successes because talking about our failures is difficult. It makes us uncomfortable. But on the subject of race, we need to feel uncomfortable because otherwise we're denying what really happened. And I don't think that serves anybody's interest. The Senate Majority Leader, and I'm not going to talk about Democrats and Republicans here, but Mr. McConnell, when the issue of reparations around slavery came up, I'm sorry, reparations around our racial history came up, he wanted to reduce it to being about slavery. And he said, well, that ended, 150 years ago. That's where the conversation about reparations ought to end. Well, I don't know what racial history he's reading, but it's not the one I'm reading, which is that discrimination and prejudice and bigotry has continued long after slavery ended. Now, I don't know that we ought to have reparations. That's a very difficult political issue, but we ought not to pretend that that's where the conversation ends with the liberation of slaves in 1865.
This is our history as a country. You state that. That's kind of our national conversation. How are we a part of the problem, and what can we do to make things better?
I think that the way we teach history, just not only about race, but about many subjects, is really important because, you know, a lot of people in high school, they think, well, that's all ancient history, has nothing to do with me. And I think making a connection between today and the past, you know, William Faulkner once said, the past isn't dead, it's not even past. There are many issues that we feel the effects of today. So if you look at statistics of white people and black people as an aggregate, and you look at the gap in wealth and education and job opportunities, you begin to see some of the consequences, the repercussions of racial separation. They are continuing today. So that when President Johnson said in 1965 that he wanted to create an equal starting line, that's why he was in favor of affirmative action, a controversial policy that some people are not in favor of. Is the starting line equal today? I think it's still unequal. That's what those statistics show. We need to make the starting line equal, really equal. We need to make sure that no matter what your color, no matter what your religion, no matter what your background, what area of the country you live in, whether it's from northern Michigan or southern Florida, whether it's from western Colorado or eastern New York, you have the same chance. And this is the essence of what I think America is really about. The real deception that we tell ourselves is that this is a country that's fair and has the same opportunities. That's our dream. It should be our dream. It is not always our reality.
I'm curious, I want to probe into that a little bit more. The practicality of that, what does that look like for people who aren't maybe in politics or sponsoring legislation? Most people, unless you're a white supremacist, aren't going to admit you're a racist. But maybe we have those racist biases that we don't even recognize. What are some practical steps that we can do in our everyday lives to get beyond that?
Well, I should be plugging my book, telling everybody to buy it, but instead I'm going to plug somebody else's book. So there's a book that came out recently, I'm sure some of the audience knows of it and has read it, by Ibram Kendi, which is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's partly a personal story. Dr. Kendi is a professor at American University. He wrote a book about the history of slavery that was the National Book Award winner. That was his first book. This book came out last year. And what he argues in it is that it's not good enough to say that I am not a racist. You have to be opposed to racism to really make a difference. And so I recommend it to you because he's a much better authority on this than I think I am.
Steve, I want to talk a little bit about your background in writing and where you got to where you are now. You grew up in Detroit. Tell us a little bit about your childhood, where you grew up, where you went to school.
Well, I'm old enough that when I was rooting for the Detroit Red Wings, there were only six teams in the NHL. Saturday night, hockey night in Canada. Windsor. We had it on our TV set. I grew up in the city of Detroit. I had a recent experience that's very funny. I was in an elevator at Johns Hopkins University going down to the stacks of the library. There's only one other guy in the elevator, so I'm one of those guys who talks on elevators. I don't like to just sit there in silence. He had on a Detroit Tigers baseball cap. And so I said, he was black, it's relevant. He was black, I was white. I said to him, I'm from Detroit too. And he said, where are you really from? Because of course I was white, so I was from some suburb. This guy was about 4 inches taller than I am. I am 6'3". So I put my nose in his chest and I said, I'm really from Detroit. You want to make something of it? He said, East Side. I said, West Side. He said, all right. Anyway, I went to Henry Ford High School. If any of you know Detroit, it's on the northwest side. I was on the school newspaper. I went on to college. I was on the college newspaper. When I graduated from college, I took a good look at my credentials, realized that I was qualified to do nothing, and therefore I went into journalism, where you don't need any qualifications or a degree. There's, you know, no licensing in journalism. When I was about, how old was I in 67 when the uprising, the riots occurred? I was 15. And from my house, you could see the smoke, not the flames, from some of the burning that was going on. But I wanted to know what that was all about. And so I rode the bus downtown frequently, and I went to the Detroit Public Library and the Institute of Art. And when I met some kids from the suburbs, they didn't let us meet anybody from the suburbs when I was young. No, that's a joke. They said, "You ride the bus downtown?" I said, "Yeah, I do. I go to the Tiger Games, you know, on Michigan Avenue." But I don't know Detroit as well as I know Baltimore, where I live now, because one of the things that, you know, being a newspaper reporter is like a passport to interfere and intervene in everybody's life. And so I know Baltimore in ways that I don't know Detroit. So that's my experience growing up a little bit. And I returned to Detroit for my first book because I told this family secret about my own family and my secret aunt. That's Annie's Ghosts, if any of you know it, which is a Michigan Notable book and the Great Michigan Read. And that brought me back to Detroit, and I spent probably the equivalent of about 2 or 3 months researching here. And then this book also brought me back because the justice that I mentioned, Henry Billings Brown from Massachusetts, who landed in Detroit, his papers, such as they are, at the Detroit Public Library. And so I spent a good long time there, and also in Marshall, Michigan, because he had some family there. And so there's stuff that is in the library in Marshall.
I'm curious. I'm a journalist. You're a journalist. How was it transitioning between writing for newspaper and then writing your own book?
It's like the equivalent of playing Little League versus playing big leagues. No, it's not quite that bad. No, I think the problem is, so this is about audience, right? What's the audience for news? And let's not talk about newspapers because they're soon to be obsolete. News, the audience is, people want information and they want it pretty quickly. They don't want to spend a long time reading a long story in most cases. I mean, newspapers and podcasts have a way of alerting you that, hey, this is a long story. And then now online, you know, you'll see 8-minute read. You know, something that says 2-minute read. 2-minute read, wow. All those words that I crafted, 2-minute read. A book, my agent's associate told me, I thought, the best advice. He was reading the first, this was Annie's Ghost, he was reading the first few chapters, and he said, "Steve, they give you about 50 pages before they decide whether they like it or not because they already bought the book." Like, you don't need to rush it. You don't need to be like you are in the newspaper. You're rushing it here. Let it breathe. Let it expand. That's hard for a newspaper reporter to learn what that really means. I mean, it sounds easy to say, like, what do you mean let it breathe? What does that mean? And what it means is, describe people, describe the scene, put in details you would never put in telling details, not irrelevant details, telling details that you'd never be able to put in a news story because you only have 1,000 words or something. You know, this book is 120,000 words. This one is, I'm not going to tell you how long this one is.
Do you think we'd be in a different place today if that case was decided differently?
You know, historians call that the counterfactual. We don't like counterfactuals because it's an alternative universe that we don't understand, we don't know. I'm sorry to tell you this, but there was no way that Plessy would have come out any differently. Now, you might have asked, well, what if that case was never brought? Would it have been brought by someone else? I think the answer is yes. It might have taken a few years longer, but I think it would have been brought. The major thing that was happening in the 1880s and 90s is that these policies that were developed by railroads in the 1830s and 40s, these rules of companies had become laws now. That's a big difference, right? The 14th Amendment says that states shall make no laws abridging the rights of its citizens. You would think that this is a law by a state abridging the rights of its citizens. I'm going to read in a minute from John Harlan's dissent, The Ringing Dissent, because the reason they said it was okay was, well, it's equally discriminatory. Whites can't sit in the black car, blacks can't sit in the white car. It's equally discriminatory. Well, here's what Harlan said about that. Now remember, Harlan was the only dissenter, so he had to sit in a room with his colleagues, and he had to say, I disagree with you. Not an easy thing to do when you're sitting among Supreme Court justices, I bet. So here's what he said. The majority ruling, Harlan was convinced, was an affront to the Constitution. It would, quote, stimulate aggressions, more or less brutal and irritating, upon the admitted rights of colored citizens. It would, quote, encourage the belief, end quote, that state law could be deployed to stymie the intention of the three Reconstruction Amendments. Here's the key lines. Quote, we boast of the freedom enjoyed by our people among all other peoples, he wrote. But it is difficult to reconcile that boast with a state of the law which practically puts the brand of servitude and degradation upon a large class of our fellow citizens, our equals before the law. The thin disguise of equal accommodations for passengers and railroad coaches will not mislead anyone, nor atone for the wrong this day done. In my opinion, he wrote, the judgment this day rendered will in time prove to be as pernicious as the decision made by this tribunal in the Dred Scott case. And Harlan was right. But he was in the minority. He was the lone dissenter.
Let's hear it for Steve Luxenberg, ladies and gentlemen.
That was Steve Luxenberg talking with Dan Wanchura. Steve Luxenberg's latest book is Separate, The Story of Plessy versus Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.